From New England, the haunted, sacred Cradle of Liberty, galloping out over the grand, majestic reaches of the Union, out to the last dying embers of the Republic, I'm Tom Moore.
And I'm Scott DeNito.
And you are on the Midnight Ride! Huzzah!
And welcome, Patriots. The Midnight Ride is a revolutionary podcast about the life and times of early colonial America, the victories and challenges, and the successes and struggles of the founders and keepers of the young republic. And you can visit us at www.themidnightridecast.com. This is Scott here.
Recorded Tom.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey, you know, we've got with us, you're here, I'm here. Sam Adams is here.
Plank, huzzah.
As always, huzzah. But we got a couple other folks with us here tonight.
Well, first thing I want to say, you guys heard that wicked James Bond-style bumper music, and we're going to have that all tonight because that's what kind of show we've got for ya.
So it's indicative of who we have with us, maybe.
Yes.
Okay, well, spill the beans. Who's here?
Well, Big Minute Man, we have a great co-host today, former guest on our show, and the nation's leading expert on how weather affects history. Himself, a Minuteman reenactor, and also a professional broadcaster, the voice of the Boston Bruins, the New England Patriots alumni. John Horrigan, welcome back to the Midnight Ride. Huzzah.
Huzzah. Welcome, John.
Welcome. It's good to see you guys in person.
I know. It's great to see you in person.
Let's hear a huzzah. You're a Minuteman.
Huzzah!
All right.
Freedom!
Well, tell us a little about yourself, John.
Well, yeah, I think you gave me a good upfront bio, so if I break out into my sports announcer voice, the listeners at home will understand, but I've had a fascination with historical meteorology and historical fires for quite some time, and I see how it does impact history and impacts decisions made by major leaders or military operations, and I still have the passion for it to this very moment.
Yeah, cool. You know, I thought that was a very interesting conversation we actually had a few weeks ago about how weather impacts historical events, and it's something that I never actually would have thought about it at that time. And I bet you must have tons of other stories about how weather has impacted history.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a really odd, rainy, and cool summer. And I've been studying something known as the Year Without a Summer, which impacted the world in 1816, which I think is a fascinating story.
You're right. That is really strange. And we're going to get to that, John. But as for now, well, Scott, I think today will mark a new frontier for the Midnight Ride.
You mean a final frontier?
Where no man has gone before.
Being the theme of the Kennedy administration, which they believed in technology. And, you know, we, in fact, are going to attempt to use technology to locate and interview the former president, who is also a historian.
We call it the Liberty Bell. And I don't know if you'd classify it as a time machine or what.
Tom, I mean, you know, Back to the Future is one of my favorite movies, right? What did we do? Use the flux capacitor or something mounted on a DeLorean sports car, which had to be moving at 88 miles an hour to work out?
That wouldn't work too well here, would it?
Well, not in my small apartment. On the other hand, the Liberty Bell, as we call this beast, basically uses existing Tesla technology that works on the theory of parallel universes. Mm.
So basically, that theory sees time as happening all at once in the present, meaning everything that has happened actually is happening right now in some parallel dimension.
Exactly. So in one parallel universe, the Declaration of Independence is being signed right now. And in another, Daniel Webster is giving a speech before the Senate as we speak. And in yet another, men are fighting and dying on a Gettysburg farm.
Right. So we are going to basically fold over into the universe where Jack Kennedy is still president and transport him into our universe temporarily.
So that's right. Except that we have to be extremely careful not to discuss things that will happen afterwards. For example, President Kennedy's impending assassination, or it could totally screw up the space-time continuum.
And for those of us born after that time, which is all of us here, if things had somehow gone radically differently, it's conceivable that we might not have ever been born.
Well, Tom, maybe some of us really shouldn't have been born.
Ha! Says you. Well, it's a good thing we have a weather expert on with us today, because the first time we cranked this sucker up, a lightning storm erupted over Boston, and we had two solid months of rain. So, John, in your professional opinion, if we turn this baby on, is there even, say, a 10% chance that we could, say, fry the whole ionosphere?
You guys basically eliminated what would have been, according to my research, a wonderfully nice, mild, sunny summer. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, but John, doesn't the historian side of you want to be able to interview JFK?
Oh, absolutely. Hey, guys, I don't want to seem like I'm anti-technology, but I'm here to tell you that the possibility of creating a permanent, catastrophic, and irreversible weather anomaly is very real, and we shouldn't just sweep it under the rug. Add to the fact that we'll be physically transporting the president here. I mean, don't you think that sudden dimensional shift might just be a tad unsettling?
Oh, good point. You might not be happy, Scott. You might just want to keep your finger on the old bleep button just in case.
Yeah, and Scott, if your calculations are even slightly off, Jack could materialize 8 feet behind us with his head wedged in the door of your freezer.
If that happened, it would be stuck there with all the other frost in the inside of my freezer. Anyway, you know, John, I think what you're referring to is the Philadelphia experiment, and that's when they experimented with that naval destroyer, the USS Eldridge, oh, and its yeah. crew. Mm-hmm. And basically what they did was they did a time warp experiment. Yep. So, okay.
Electromagnetism, I think.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, Einstein's
unified field theory
effect.
Playing around with that.
Yep. So, you know, you're right, and it's a little disturbing.
I think that, do you want to say what happened there, Scott, and just a little bit about the disaster?
The Philadelphia, well, the legend of the Philadelphia experiment is, actually, it's really kind of creepy from what I understand. Yeah. It was an experiment with magnetism, supposedly, and basically these huge electromagnets that were put on the ship to create, I guess what you call it, a time warp, a space-time
right,
warp.
Right, right,
you know, but what happened was there were reports the ship disappeared from the port it was in and appeared in, I believe, two other ports simultaneously.
Yeah.
When it reappeared, there were stories of sailors that were actually fused in between pieces of metal and all of this other stuff, you know what I mean?
It was, some caught fire, some went mad.
Right, yeah.
Some were wedged in the deck of the ship.
Exactly. So others, I guess what you could call phased in and out of this reality,
yeah.
if you believe in the many worlds theory.
Right. But John, really, the Eldridge disaster was way back in 1943. I mean, heck, there wasn't even TV back then. Space-time compression has come a long, long way since that time. Plus, here in Boston, we got MIT geeks stumbling all over the place. And I believe you and me have done our homework, haven't we, Scott?
Absolutely. There's an MIT frat house right behind us here in the Back Bay. It's actually right behind where we're talking right
yeah.
now. And after a party one night, Tom and I found this device kicking around in the basement of the unit next door that we kind of broke into when we shouldn't have. We were out of Sam Adams.
You know, we were looking for some beers.
Yeah, and we started partying with them after we ran into them. But
we're down in the basement. They got a refrigerator. And then we trip over this baby. And it's hard to believe it was just lying there collecting dust. Yep. I mean, they haven't even turned it on since 1972 back in the Apollo program.
Right, the ending days of the yeah. Apollo program. Well, mm-hmm. you know, Tom, it's a good thing that you had that $50 in your wallet.
I think it's a good investment. I mean, we're investing in the Midnight Ride's
right.
ability to contact major historical figures for our listeners.
Right. Exactly.
Times are tough these days. I thought $50 was a fair price. They weren't using it. Whoa, but man, oh man, was that sucker ever heavy?
Well, it was. But you know, you're not kidding. All those vacuum tubes and transistors weigh a ton. I'm actually kind of surprised that these guys are smart for being able to make something like this work with vacuum tubes, I'll tell you. But we had to pay them another $50 just to get help moving it in here. So,
Time out. I don't know what kind of drugs you're on, guys, but the weather implications for the East Coast alone are absolutely staggering.
John, listen to yourself. Jack Kennedy believed in technology. He told us we were going to put a man on the moon, and by God, we did it. If he were here today, as he soon will be, I know he'd say to go for it.
Okay. But guys, please don't mention anything that happens after his visit, like the moon landing or poof. We will all three of us disappear right in the middle of this podcast, never having been born.
Okay, if we did the math correctly, I think we're going to transport him directly from the middle of the speech he gave, or should I say is giving, at Amherst College on October 26, 1963.
Of course, Tom, I wrote the software.
Mm-hmm. We're in good hands.
But anyways, you know, guys, I think we're ready.
All righty. I think we are. Crank it up and fasten your seatbelts, time travelers. As we ring the Liberty Bell for the first time.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah, flick the switch.
I look forward to an America which will not be afraid of grace and beauty, which will protect the beauty of our natural environment, which will preserve the old American houses, squares, parks,
our national past, which will build handsome and balanced cities for our future.
Jesus, Mary, Joseph, what the hell am I doing here?
President John F. Kennedy, you are on the Midnight Ride.
I was just out in Amherst giving a speech. It was a beautiful day. wonderful people there. What the hell did I do to land this godforsaken hole?
And by the way, welcome to 2009. We hope you had a nice flight. Would you care for a nice frosty Sam Adams beer?
Oh, great. I've been kidnapped by the Three Stooges of time travel. What the hell did you guys want from me anyway?
Actually, Mr. President, we're big fans of yours, big fans of history, and we'd like to talk to you about it, especially your wonderful book, Profiles in Courage. So if you could take maybe a half hour or so to share with our 2009 audience your perspectives on history, then we'll beam you back to that warm October day in Amherst, and you can go ahead and finish your speech.
Sounds like I don't have a choice here. It reminds me of when Bobby told me that we had to take Lyndon on the ticket. Anyway, you three hooligans, go ahead, do your damnedest, and then send me back to Amherst so I can get on with my speech there and my presidency. Unfortunately, I have a very busy schedule. I have to go out and fix a few party problems in Dallas next month, so I don't have a lot of time to chit-chat.
Very well, and thank you, Mr. President.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, sir.
You know, Mr. President, we were really inspired from day one by that fantastic inaugural speech that you wrote. Can you give us just a little bit of it?
Well, I didn't write it, Tom. Ted Sorensen did, but I gave it. And let me see if I can recall a little bit of that speech here now. Let me just review something. Okay, I remember now. My fellow citizens, I have sworn before you and Almighty God the same solemn oath that our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago. The world is very different now, for man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And yet the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The beliefs that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. So let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure the survival and the success of liberty. This much we pledge, and more.
Excuse me, Mr. President, my expertise is weather and history, and I must say your inaugural was one of the coldest on record. 8 inches of snow the morning of the inauguration, 22 degrees, a wind chill factor knocked the temperature down to 7 degrees, and the worst traffic jam in Washington, D.C. history. I'm wondering if your brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, was out on the road at that time. Anyways, by comparison, when William Henry Harrison...
let me just interrupt. Peter and Frank Sinatra never made it to the inaugural. They were invited. They were hungover and in a motel room that particular day. That's how cold it was.
Wow.
But by comparison, when William Henry Harrison gave his monster two-hour inaugural address, it was a cold, wet day in 1841, and he didn't wear a top coat or a hat, and he caught pneumonia. A month later, he was dead.
Well, I lasted longer than that. Thanks for that lovely bit of history, John. Hell yes, it was cold. But being from Boston, I could take it. But Lyndon was freezing his tiny little Texas balls off. Now, if you don't mind, I'll get to the main point of that speech, because who knows, maybe you and all the future kidnappers of America could use a little common sense. In the long history of the world, only a few generations.
Wait for this thing to go by.
Secret Service.
Secret Service? I wonder what they found us.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger
I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do with the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standard of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you, with a good conscience and a clear mind, with history the final judge of our deeds. Let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Wow, Jack, I think your inaugural will go down as one of the most memorable, if not the most powerful.
Yep. Talk about presidential power, huh?
Conveyed such a great feeling for your country and its place in history. By the way, I believe you're the only president ever to bring a historian with him to be part of his cabinet in the White House. That's a bit unusual, to say the least.
Of course, Tom, you mean Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and yes, he certainly was a bit unusual. But he had won a Pulitzer Prize for his great book, The Age of Jackson. And he also had a great feeling for the historical moment, coupled with the perspective of being a true intellect. So absolutely, I wanted him to be a part of my team. But it's funny, when he showed up for work the first day, he said to me, he said, "Mr. President, I have no idea what I'm doing here."
Wow, really? And what did you say?
I said, "Arthur, neither do I."
And so, Mr. President, though, how did you come to write this book?
You mean Profiles in Courage. Since first reading an account of John Quincy Adams and his struggle with the Federalist Party, I've been interested in the problems of political courage in the face of constituent pressures. So after a back operation in 1954, I had the time to do the reading and the research. Many people assisted me. However, the greatest debt is owed to my research assistant, Theodore Ted Sorensen.
So were you yourself ever a profile in courage?
It's funny you should ask that, John, because when the book came out, the critics said I should show a lot less profile and more courage. But I did vote for the appropriation to dredge the St. Lawrence Seaway, and that rankled many members of the New England fishing community, as well as longshoremen and organized labor. However, I felt it was in the nation's best interest, so I voted for it. But more than that, early on, while still a congressman, I turned squarely against my party and the Truman State Department when they handed China over to Mao. In fact, on January the 25th, 1949, I took a stand in the well of the House saying, quote, "Mr. Speaker, over the weekend, we have learned the extent of the disaster that has befallen China and the United States. The responsibility for failure rests squarely with the White House and the State Department," unquote. 5 days later, I stood up again and railed again. This time I said, and I quote, "This is the tragic story of China, whose freedom we once fought for to preserve. What our young men had saved, our diplomats and president have frittered away," unquote. I was mad as hell, speaking both as a congressman and a recent veteran of the Second World War in the Pacific Theater.
Well, so, Mr. President, your book identifies three pressures on public figures today. Can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Well, yes, Scott. The first pressure is to, quite naturally, to be like, and senators are no different than any other American in that regard. We all wish to be liked. Some of us succeed and some of us don't. You understand that, Scott. But when I first entered the Senate, I was told that...
Thanks, Mr. President.
Don't worry. There's more to come. But when I first entered the Senate, I was told that the way to get along was to go along.
And going along means more than just good fellowship. It includes the use of compromise, the sense of things possible. The second pressure upon the conscientious senator is to get reelected. And by the way, I hope all of you are registered to vote.
Yes.
All senators wish to be reelected. I'm no different in that regard. But senators who go down to defeat in a vain defense of a single principle will not be on hand to fight for that or any other principle in the future.
Got to live to fight another day.
Absolutely. And you have to be standing, you have to have a seat at the table, and you have to be on the floor of the Congress or in the executive branch. And finally, all of us have the urge to follow the example of John Stephen McGrawder of California.
Never heard of him.
You wouldn't, and he doesn't know you either. Who wrote a constituent in 1934, and I'm quoting here from one of his letters. One of the countless drawbacks of being in Congress, he wrote to one of his constituents, is that I am compelled to receive impertinent letters from jackasses like you, Tom, and everybody else, in which you say that I had promised to have the Sierra Madre Mountains reforested, and I've been in Congress only 2 months, and I haven't done it yet. Will you please take two running jumps and go to hell?
Have you ever written a letter like that, Mr. President?
Yes, I did.
You did? And what was the response?
Well, I never got one because I never mailed the letter. I already told you guys the pressure is to get reelected. But more importantly, the primary responsibility of a senator, most people assume, is to represent the views of his state. Ours, however, is a federal system, a union of relatively sovereign states whose needs differ greatly. Our oath is sworn in by the vice president. These days, I swear at the vice president. That's a different story. But seriously, when we come to Washington as senators, to paraphrase Edmund Burke, we come not as hostile ambassadors or special pleaders for our state or section, but as members of a deliberative assembly of one nation with one interest. And if local interests wholly dominate the role of each of us, then no one would be looking out for the nation's interest.
So then, Mr. President, you know, not to be rude, but why do you bother to study the quality of courage in our elected leaders? I mean, look at the clowns we've got running the place right now, and no one really cares.
Well, Scott, if you don't want to be rude, you shouldn't say anything. But, a nation which has forgotten the quality of courage, which in the past had been brought to public life, is not as likely to insist upon or reward that quality in its chosen leaders today. And in fact, we have forgotten. We may remember John Quincy Adams became president through the political schemes of Henry Clay, but we have forgotten how, as a young man, he gave up a promising senatorial career to stand by the nation. We may also remember Daniel Webster for his subservience to the National Bank much of his career, but we have forgotten his sacrifices for the national good at the close of his career. So you are right, Scott. We really do not remember, and we possibly do not care.
In that case, what was the point in profiling men of courage?
Because, Scott, people like you wouldn't understand it because you don't exhibit any courage. We need, and I'm about to leave and go back to Amherst, thank God. Scott, we need men and women like this now more than ever. We need men and women of character who can compromise political positions, but not themselves. People who can resolve the clash of interests without conceding their ideals. And furthermore, Scott, compromise does not mean cowardice. You know that. Indeed, it is frequently the compromisers and the conciliators who are faced with the extremist views of their constituents.
You're not kidding, Mr. President. When John Quincy Adams stood up for Jefferson's Embargo Act, he was pilloried right here in Massachusetts.
But he thought it would be the end of his political career, but he stuck to his guns. He wrote in his diary, and I'm quoting here, "I implore that spirit from whom every good and perfect gift descends to enable me to render essential service to my country, and that I may never be governed in my public conduct by any consideration other than my duty."
So they sent him packing, but then he later became president. So that just lasted one term. But after that, the good people of Braintree sent him back to Congress as their representative, and I heard that made him happier than anything else.
Well, actually, he was very happy to get the hell out of Braintree, number one, Scott. Yeah, wouldn't you be?
I've been there recently.
It's a long ride, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm kidding, though. It was at this time that Adams became old man eloquent.
Wow.
Devoting his remarkable prestige and tireless energies to the struggle against slavery. Now, here was a man who at one time was president, and now he's speaking as a congressman. For most yep. members of Congress, this would be a certain move backwards, but not to Mr. Adams.
Wow.
And this is what he wrote. I am a member-elect of the 22nd Congress, he recorded with pride in his personal diary. No election or appointment conferred upon me ever gave me so much pleasure. The election as president of the United States was not so half as gratifying to my innermost soul.
And it was in Congress that John Quincy Adams joined the tempestuous fight against slavery, leading to the Civil War. You know, Mr. President, my ancestor, Wyman Bradbury C.V. Moore of Maine, served in the United States Senate with senators like John Calhoun, Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, and Sam Houston, all of whom you write about. What can you say about this fateful period in our nation's history as it played out in the Senate?
Well, Tom, although history records next to nothing of your lightweight ancestor, Wayman Dingleberry Moore, he did have a ringside seat, though, for some of the biggest and heavyweight title fights the Senate has ever seen. For at that time, all in a position of responsibility were obliged to decide between maintaining their loyalty to the nation or to their region. For many on both sides, the abolitionists in the North, the fire eaters of the South, the decision came very easily. But to those who felt a dual loyalty to their state and to their country, to those who sought compromises which would postpone or remove entirely the shadow of war which hung over them, the decision was agonizing.
Wow, Mr. President, talk about climactic times and events. And one man, one very great man, a true lion of the Senate, would sacrifice his entire career and reputation for the Union, only to go down in bitter defeat. I think both of us know who that was.
Well, Tom, it sure as hell wasn't Wayman Dingleberry Moore, that long-distant relative of yours who's lost in history, never spoken above, never remembered. Nobody ever said anything good about him.
His picture's in the State House in Maine.
His picture's in your wallet, and that's what they want. But yes, we're really talking about Daniel Webster, perhaps the most extraordinary figure in American political history. One historian described him as a compound of strength, weakness, dust, and divinity. He was undoubtedly the most talented figure in congressional history. He had the gift to make alive and supreme the latent sense of oneness, of union, that all Americans felt, but few could express. Ever since his first speech in the Senate, opposing the War of 1812, and by the way, Scott, that war was in 1812. Webster was a spellbinding orator. Although not tall, he had an actor's ability to make whatever he said important. His skills were so great that he was the northern member of the great triumvirate, the other two being Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun. And I'd say that's pretty good company, other than that Dingleberry Moore.
Mr. President, exactly what kind of political courage are we talking about?
Well, America at that time was in a very precarious balance when admitting new states to the Union, that is, both slave states as well as free states. And great effort was placed upon making sure that the number of states on each side was equal. In 1850, while Webster was a senator from Massachusetts, President Taylor made a proposal which would have set that equal balance between slave and free states.
And President Taylor died from eating bad cherries. Of course, that never happened with you, Mr. President.
Well, I broke a couple of cherries.
Oops!
Wasn't that about the admission of California?
That's correct. Even though Taylor was himself a slaveholder from Louisiana, the president didn't believe in the expansion of slavery. So he proposed the addition of California as a free state without proposing the addition of any corresponding slave state, thereby upsetting the balance in the House and Senate.
But why would that proposal upset Webster? He didn't support slavery.
No, you're quite correct here, Red. In fact, Webster had, throughout his career, made speeches condemning that peculiar institution, as slavery was called. And New England, in the first half of the 18th century, was a stronghold for abolitionists. Here's a quote of Webster regarding slavery. He wrote, "I shall oppose all slavery extension and all increase of slave representation in all places, at all times, under all circumstances, even against all inducements, against all supposed limitations of great interest, against all compromises." However, Webster was also afraid of secession.
So had the South made any concrete steps towards secession?
As concrete as Jimmy Hoffa's shoes, you son of a bitch. When Taylor had suggested the admission of California as a free state, South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun, a strong proponent of slavery, suggested a convention of Southerners at Nashville for June of 1850 to popularize the idea of dissolution of the Union.
So why didn't they?
Actually, there was one other senator besides Webster who loved the idea of union more than he loved his region. And that senator was Henry Clay of Kentucky. And Clay was already known as the Great Compromiser for his work in preserving the Union by offering the Missouri Compromise of 1820.
1820. Missouri was admitted as a slave state and Maine came in as a free state. You know, Mr. President, Wyman Bradbury C.B. Moore was just a young lad of 11 at that time, growing up in the little New England town of Waterville. Little did he know that he would one day serve with all those great senators. Little did he know.
Tom, so help me, you bring up that dingleberry one more time, and I'll use that time machine. I'm going to send you back to Abu Ghraib. So anyway, Clay had worked out the Union's compromise in 1820, and now, as an old man, he was approaching the northern giant of the Senate, Daniel Webster, in an effort to strike yet another compromise.
But why did Webster support Clay's compromise?
Because Webster feared that civil violence, and I'm quoting here, would only rivet the chains of slavery even more strongly. And the preservation of the Union was far nearer to his heart than his opposition to slavery. Webster told a friend he intended to, quote, make an honest truth-telling speech and a Union speech and discharge his clear conscience.
Oh, so by delivering this speech, Webster knew he was running a great risk, right?
Oh, yes, he did. In fact, Webster was admonished by friends and by constituents, by newspapers, not to agree with the Clay Compromise. But by March the 6th of 1850, Webster had made up his mind.
What was Webster's speech called?
It became known as the 7th of March. And it's one of the few speeches in American political history that is not known by its title, but by the date that it was given. And he started it by saying to a full and overflowing Senate, "Mr. President, I wish to speak today not as a Massachusetts man, nor as a Northern man, but as an American and a member of the United States Senate. I speak today for the preservation of the Union. Hear me for my cause." He spoke over 3 hours. He pleaded for the Union.
Was that long-winded at the time?
Not at all, no. In fact, many speeches were carried over from day to day and went for considerable amounts of time. But Webster was an extraordinary orator. When he spoke, it didn't matter how long he spoke. He had everyone's attention.
When he talked, people listened.
They did. He attacked any peaceful secession. In fact, he argued against there would be any peaceful secession. And he asked for conciliation, understanding, all in the name of patriotism.
So how is the 7th of March speech received?
In the North, Webster was vilified by the abolitionists. Here are some of the quotes that were given in the local newspapers in the North, which was heavily abolitionist. Here's one quote. "No living man has done so much to disgrace the conscience of this nation." Here's another quote directed at Webster. "A fallen star, Lucifer descended from heaven." And here's one more quote. "The most meanly and foolish, treacherous man I have ever heard of."
Wow. Was he reelected as senator from Massachusetts?
No, he never ran after he gave that speech. In fact, he resigned as senator from Massachusetts after he delivered the 7th of March speech. And he became Secretary of State. And he ran for president 2 years later in 1852. And in fact, that's when he died, Marshfield, Massachusetts, 1852.
My hometown. So other than ending Daniel Webster's political career, what did his 7th of March speech accomplish?
Just what he wanted. Preservation of the Union, even if it was for only another 10 years.
I heard that Webster didn't know it at the time, but him buying that extra 10 years actually gave the North enough time to industrialize and have the power to actually keep the Union together, that if we had broken up at that point, there's a good chance we'd be two countries right now,
exactly,
Mr. President.
Exactly, Tom, and a lot of historians agree with that assessment.
So it sounds like the actions of one person really may have changed the tide of how things really played out?
Well, don't forget there were two people to this compromise. It was Henry Clay from the South and Daniel Webster from the North, two of the three members of the Great Triumphant.
So two people kind of bending each of their views to keep this thing going.
Precisely. The five compromises that were in the Compromise of 1850, two of them were to the South's disadvantage and two of the provisions were to the North's disadvantage. So it was a compromise that served its purpose, however many felt, and it did ultimately come to pass that the Civil War was upon us 10 years later.
I can see in your book here, wonderful. Everybody go out there. We have it, President Kennedy's book, posted right there as a companion to this podcast.
Correct.
Profiles in Courage.
Should be right on the front page.
Even as some of Webster's best friends, like Emerson. Emerson, of course, wrote the Concord Hymn, which was inaugurated with the statue, fire the shot heard round the world. You know, everybody loved Emerson. He and Webster were great friends, but then even Emerson turned on him and called him profoundly selfish, you know. So he even lost some of his best friends.
He died, I would say, an honorable man, but maybe a broken man at that point.
Mm-hmm. Honorable from our extended perspective of history, but dishonored in his time by his best friends, you know.
Many of the abolitionists in New England felt that he had betrayed the cause. However, Webster felt that the Union was more important.
Moving forward to Texas, Mr. President, you have a vice president who is from Texas, Lyndon Johnson.
Yes. Actually, I'm going on tour of Texas with him next month, and I'm looking forward to it as I would a root canal. Funny, though, Lyndon once said to me that being the vice president wasn't worth a pitcher of warm piss, and as it turns out, neither is he. In fact, Bobby and I may have to drop him from the ticket this time around. Oh. Don't tell Lyndon. But Sam Houston, he was a different story, and he's also profiled in my book, Profile in Courage. The great founding hero of Texas was, in the final analysis, an American first and a Texan second. In 1857, he was dismissed from his Senate seat by the Texas legislature. It was then that he declared, and I'm quoting here, "I wish no prouder epitaph to mark the board or slap that may lie upon my tomb than this. He loved his country. He was a patriot. He was devoted to the Union. It is for this that I have suffered martyrdom." Beautiful quote by
yes.
a great patriot.
So was that the last that Texas or America ever saw of him?
No, Scott. Sam Houston had a hell of a lot more fight left in him. He went back home to Texas, and he fought a bitter campaign for governor. When Lincoln was elected president, Texas seceded, and all were required to take a loyalty oath to the Confederacy, all except the governor himself, who declared, and I'm quoting here, "Fellow citizens, in the name of your rights and liberty, which I believe have been trampled upon, I refuse to take this oath. In the name of my own conscience and my own manhood, I refuse to take this oath. I love Texas too well to bring civil strife and bloodshed upon her," unquote. Sam Houston ended his career by standing by the Union in the name of safety and common sense when everyone else in his home state had war fever. Now that, my friends, is a true profile in courage.
So in closing, Mr. President, what do you see as the primary value of exploring American history?
Well, John, history isn't a guide to the present, but in the archives building down Pennsylvania Avenue, There's a stone plaque which says, what's past is prologue. While history doesn't give us a key to the future, I think it does give us a sense of confidence in the future. This country has passed through very difficult days, but it has passed through them. And it is rather interesting to realize that we are a rather old republic, probably the oldest republic in the world. When we were founded, there was a king in France, a czar in Russia, an emperor in Peking. All that's been wiped away, and that this country continues and will continue in the future. We in the present, both those that are in politics and those of you who study us and record what we did right or what we may have done wrong, we represent a long effort, building on the lives and contributions of all the great American people of the past. So our history is a source of strength to us. And anything which dramatizes the great story of the United States, such as this website, I feel is worthy of our closest attention.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. And we do apologize for any inconvenience, but I think that this show may be our best one.
Absolutely, Tom. I think I agree with you. I think this is probably the best show we've done to date. I mean, how many podcasts out there are able to bring back historical figures for you of such magnitude and importance?
None. And unfortunately, now we have to go ahead and send the president back to his speech in Amherst in late October 1963. Good luck, and thank you so much, President John F. Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Tom, Scott, and John, and it was great to meet the three of you. Now we can get back to that speech in Amherst. It was a beautiful day. We're all remembering Robert Frost and the importance of the arts. And I look forward to an America which will not be afraid of grace and beauty. I look forward to an America which will reward achievement in the arts as we reward achievement in business or statecraft. And I look forward to an America which commands respect throughout the world, not only for its strength, but for its civilization as well. And I look forward to a world...
Well, Midnight Riders, you've just heard a completely different presentation than what you normally hear in the show. We probably fooled you a little bit in the beginning, but I have a good feeling that you probably caught on a little bit later as to what exactly we were up to.
And we hope you enjoyed this wild and woolly roller coaster ride with JFK, because we really worked our blinguses off in order to get you really good history. We went into the archives of what JFK had said in his speeches, of what the wit that he displayed in public interviews, in the White House tour, in his wonderful book, Profiles in Courage, which you can buy as a companion to this podcast.
Yeah, right on the website, you can buy this as a companion. But, you know, when you do read that book, you're going to learn exactly what I learned through this, which was JFK knew a lot more about American history than I knew, than probably most presidents have known. And I have a good feeling, based on some of the things that I learned, that he was really taking that knowledge and that wisdom and using that to guide the decisions that he would make in his administration and presidency.
Absolutely. And with that, we know exactly what's on your mind right now. Who is this mystery JFK? Well, his name is Mike Lowe. He's a local New Englander, actually from Braintree, which we joked about a little bit.
It was a long ride.
we went out, we rehearsed this at his apartment in Braintree. Anyway, Mike is a great, probably I would say the nation's top reenactor and Kennedy scholar in terms of actually becoming JFK, especially through his voice, through the speeches. His website is jfkexperience.com. And without further ado, we're going to find out who Mike Lowe is. Mike, you want to tell us a little bit about how you became JFK?
Well, I'm not an impersonator. I try to bring his voice back to life. But many years ago, after the president was assassinated, my mother bought a record, and it had the president's speeches on it. As a young boy, I used to listen to those speeches. And here I am now as an older man, and I'm trying to repeat those speeches still.
You know, when I listened to JFK speeches, I started really listening to them probably about a year or 2 years ago, because there's a website out there. It's called archive.org, www.archive.org, which its goal is to archive pretty much everything that's been on the internet started in 96. They have most of his speeches available. So I started downloading them, listening to him. And I was pretty amazed at how well of a speaker JFK really was. When you listen to the speeches from beginning to end, it's definitely something you've really channeled and captured amazingly. Did you kind of get that sense when you were a kid listening to these records? Did you get that same feeling I may have when I'm listening to his speeches?
No, not at all, because I was just a kid. And I just knew that Jack Kennedy was from Boston, Massachusetts. I was a young boy from Boston and Massachusetts. He was Irish. I'm Irish. He was Catholic. I'm Catholic.
You drink a lot.
Yeah, well, me too. All right, brother.
Right. Not at that time, though. It was just a matter of he had a great cadence, and I knew that he was a remarkable man, even as a kid.
Yeah, and as a kid, I got introduced to JFK by a JFK bust sitting in my grandmother's living room. I always thought to myself, why is this the only artifact of a U.S. president that my grandmother has?
You never thought that you would have in your apartment a talking bust of JFK.
That is exactly what it felt like.
And the question I have for all of you listeners out there is, do you want more Jack? Do you want to sit down at a round table with President Kennedy, hear him discuss things like his military experience on PT-109, his family, his lovely wife Jacqueline, Marilyn Monroe, his presidency, more excerpts from speeches? Man, oh man, do we ever have it all, Big Minute Man.
Absolutely. And in order to get that, you need to sign up at our website.
How do they do that?
They need to go to www.themidnightridecast.com. That's www.themidnightridecast.com. Once you're there, look for the blue button at the top of the screen. It says sign up. And when you click that button, you'll be brought to a page where you just enter a username that you come up with and a password, and you're signed up.
Very, very easy. And with that, why don't we go to one of our listener mails?
Yes, Tom. John from Pennsylvania writes in, I just started listening to your podcast. I must say that it has become my favorite, and you guys do an outstanding job. Huzzah!
Huzzah!
He says, huzzah. Keep up the good work, and I really enjoy the interviews with Dr. Vier so much so that I bought his book, Constitutional Homeland Security, today.
Did you hear that, Edwin?
I live in an area of western Pennsylvania that is pretty rich in the French and Indian War history, and I live about 10 miles directly from the Bushy Run battlefield site. Well, thanks a lot, John, out in Pennsylvania. Tom, actually, we've talked about in the past taking some extended road trips once we get the financial support in order to
do that. Absolutely. And one road trip that a lot of you Midnight Riders want to make is to the New England History Festival. That is in Watertown, Massachusetts, Saturday, November 14th, 2009. You want to go to www.historyfestival.org. Big Minute Man, myself, Mike Lowe is going to be giving one of Kennedy's famous speeches, the Cuban Missile speech. And the host is Mr. John Horgan, who is here. So you can get all of us knuckleheads in one place at this wonderful history festival. Should be a great time.
It will be a great time, absolutely. And again, folks, you know, remember, email us. Email us questions. Correct us when we get our history wrong, you know.
Absolutely.
Give us good jokes, colonial American jokes. That would be great. You know, hosts at themidnightridecast.com. That's hosts at themidnightridecast.com. And while you're at the website, actually click that button. There's a button there that says vote for us. That's voting for us on podcastalley.com. It's a website that will allow our podcast to actually grow and reach more listeners, which will help us continue to be able to stay on the air with you. So
absolutely. The last plug we want to give is to Mr. Chuck Edwards, musician Chuck, friend of ours up on the North Shore.
The great music that you heard in there was from Chuck. He's awesome.
And what you want to do is go to MySpace, click on music, and type in The Undertows. You can hear more great music by Chuck and his band, The Undertows. And if you want to order the CD, you can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just before signing off here, we did mention to sign up to get the special content. But the special content that we have in this podcast is special content.
We didn't even mention the killer blooper reel we got.
Yeah, you like
all that humor? There's a lot of stuff we just couldn't put in the feature content for a lot of reasons. We have school children listening in.
You go to that extra content, you're going to get the killer blooper reel of your, I mean, it's like, what, about 10 minutes of R-rated bloopers on the reel.
And we know a lot of you listen to this and you kind of sit on the fence. You really want to sign up for this one. Trust us. So I guess, Tom, we're at the end of a laborious but worthy podcast.
Hope you liked it.
We hope you liked it. And I guess there's only one thing left to say.
What's that?